So, Berto, have you seen the new movie Mother! Exclamation point. Have you seen that movie in the theaters yet?
Oh, have I! Exclamation point.
Yeah, I knew the answer to that question already because I saw you post on Facebook. You said, and I never know if you're being sarcastic or not, so I thought he hated it or you said you thought it was in your top five movies of all time.
Instant classic.
That's that. So you weren't being sarcastic.
I was not being sarcastic. Now, since then, I have tried to, I actually tried to do a top five and I found it was impossible. And I actually like your idea of doing tiers, like what you did for the Beatles. So in doing tiers, it's in my top tier.
Okay.
But I just can't actually say, oh, it's my top five movies.
Right. Because there's other movies that you would, you wouldn't put it necessarily above.
Like I was, we should probably start the podcast.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I am your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I am a therapist and a professor and not a mother, exclamation point.
My name is Humberto Castañeda. I am a publicist for a select poet.
Maybe the title was, You Mother! So I liked it for sure, but I gave it a 7 out of 10, which is my ranking for definitely a good, worth my time, definitely liked it.
Right.
I tend to reserve the 10s, the 9s, and the 8s for movies where I'm... Like, I just watched The Big Sick today. Have you seen that movie?
Not yet, no.
I gave that movie a 9 out of 10. That's an amazing movie. Oh. It's a perfect story. It's funny throughout.
Right.
It's dry humor, but I was laughing out loud, like, every 5 minutes.
Oh, I'll have to check it out.
It's a true story, too, which is amazing.
I see.
It's an American story. It's great. Yeah. Kumail Nanjiani and Zoe Kazan are great.
The Big Sick?
The Big Sick.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a play on words in that it's like Sikh, I think, is, you know, how they call people from India. But he's Sikh. He's Muslim. But also he meets this girl and she gets sick.
Okay.
And so it's the big sick. I don't know the exact. But anyway, it's a true story, which is amazing. Anyway. Okay. So, yeah. Mother, I gave 7 out of 10. I really loved the first half. And I was on the edge of my seat. I love Aronofsky's style. We should talk a little bit about Aronofsky just for a second. What other movies do you know by him, Berto?
Well, the first movie, I think the first movie I saw was actually Requiem, and then I saw Pi.
Okay.
But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yeah.
And then I certainly saw Black Swan, and I also saw The Wrestler.
It's The Wrestler,
right?
Yeah.
I did not see The Fountain.
Okay.
Wow.
You should see The Fountain.
I heard mixed things about that.
If you like Mother, you'll love The Fountain.
Okay. What's the other one that I saw?
Noah.
Oh, yeah. I saw Noah. And then isn't there one more that I saw? You should know. You should know what I've seen.
So I saw Pi in 1998. I've always been an art film lover, and I remember...
Did you see it in the theater?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, me neither.
But I definitely remember seeing it before Requiem. And I remember just being blown away by Pi. I recently rewatched some clips of Pi, and I was like, I don't think I would like this movie today. But in 1998, 27-year-old Kirk really, really got into this movie.
I see.
It's very art filmy. It's very gritty. It's very depressing. But I liked the energy of it. I remember at the time, I mean, think about 1998, there wasn't a lot of really...
It's pre-Matrix.
Yeah, right. 2000, 2 years later, he made Requiem, which was his big sort of breakout movie. Jared Leto is in it.
I mean, I think what happened is I had seen Requiem and I was like, oh my God, I love this. I think I was at a party talking to someone and maybe that movie came up and they said, well, you've seen Pi, right? And I'm like... Pi? No. He's like, but is it about the number Pi? He's like, you haven't seen Pi? And they literally snapped it into the DVD or VCR, whatever they had, and they started playing it.
In the middle of the party?
In the middle of a party. But it was like in a separate room, and I had already had quite a few drinks. So that first time, I remember like sort of half watching and then kind of zoning out and falling asleep for a bit. So I didn't get at all what was happening, and I had to go back. And it's a hard movie to follow if you're at all not, you know, paying attention.
Then he wrote a movie called Below in 2002, which I don't remember seeing. And then 2006, wrote and directed The Fountain, which you have to see. It is the most similar. It's sort of like you've seen Noah, right?
Yeah.
So Mother is like Noah and The Fountain had a love child.
I see.
So The Fountain is okay. is lots of – it's just great. I find the – now, people out there listening to this, if – you don't like any of these movies, then you're going to hate Mother. You know. Oh, by the way, we're going to spoil the entire
movie. Oh, super spoiler.
Yeah, we're going to spoil the whole thing. And it's the sort of movie that, I don't know about you, Berto, but I had no idea.
Zero.
Yeah, all I knew was Aronofsky and J-Law and Bardem, and I was like, I'm in.
I mean, I had seen that little short preview clip where he sees something broken and he says, no, or whatever, you know, he gets angry. And I was like, what is this? And that's all I had seen.
I don't think I'd even seen that.
And so I thought it was some sort of like scary movie.
Yeah. Well, they marketed it as a scary horror movie.
But that's all I had seen or heard. And then I had heard that there was some huge controversy. So going into seeing it, and I had to wait a whole week because I was in Sweden. And so I had to wait to get back. And every day I was like, oh, I can't wait to get back. Can't wait to get back. And then I heard I got an F cinema score. And I'm like, I can't wait to see it. So I was really excited to see it, but I knew nothing.
Well, I was in London at the time and went and saw it because I really wanted to see it.
Yeah, I didn't have a slot because it was for work, for my publicist and publicisting.
Yeah. By the way, I posted on the Facebook page that I was in London and went to Freud's London home.
I saw his couch.
Yeah.
It's very like old school.
Yeah. Our Austrian friends were laughing, I think, about me saying it was Freud's home because they're like, this isn't his, you know, he's from Vienna. But anyway, it was amazing to, I went to Freud's. Can we just go on a little Freud jag here?
Yes, Freud tangent.
So we went to Freud's ashes, which is at this crematorium, and I go into the office and I'm on the internet trying to, you know, and you have to triangulate where this place is, blah, blah, blah. I finally get there. It's like outside of London. Go to the crematorium, and it's this huge cemetery-like place, a complex. And it's not like they have like a you are here map, you know what I mean? And so I finally find the particular house that his ashes are in, and it's locked. And it says you have to go to the office to get the key.
Oh, it wasn't like some normal touristy?
No.
Oh.
So I go to the office and I say, you know, I want to see Freud's ashes. And she's like, what? And I'm like, well, on the door it says you need a key. And she's like, and at this point I'm thinking, oh, God damn it. I came all the way up here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, well, maybe this guy can help. And this guy is like folding boxes. I can see him in the background. And she turns to him and she's like, this guy wants to see Freud's ashes. And he's like, yeah, I'll help you in a second. And I'm just standing there in the office for probably, I don't know, 20 minutes watching, like I'm just trying to stay out of the way of all these workers. And I can see this guy in the back room, like folding boxes. And I'm just thinking, what am I doing here? And so the guy, he comes up to me and he's like, okay, let's go. And so, great. So we finally go over there. He unlocks the door. I think he's just going to unlock the door and let us in, and I'm going to go in there,
right?
Take a couple snapshots, and then, you know, get a cab and go to the Freud House Museum, which is actually kind of nearby. Not coincidentally, I think. But anyway, but he lets us in, and then he starts to kind of chat me up. He starts asking me questions like, oh, you know, why are you here? Are you in the business? Mm-hmm. And then he starts busting out all these like snapshots of other people who have been there.
Whoa.
And then did you see that picture with the reflection?
Yeah.
He engineered that. He had this spotlight that he had brought from home or something. He's just a maintenance guy, by the way.
What?
Yeah. And so he's become an expert on Freud's ashes because you need a key to get in there.
That's crazy.
And he's walked thousands of people back to these ashes. And he's written poems about Freud, which I have on video, by the way. I'm going to post it tomorrow.
Gosh.
He's written poems. He's a painter too. He looks like he's about 65 or something. And he's a maintenance guy at this crematorium, like the guy who mows the lawn, the guy who has the keys, the guy, you know. And he read poems about death. He wrote poems about about Freud. He had that spotlight so he could get my reflection. He's like, you got to get your reflection on the on the thing,
and, which was a cool picture.
Yeah, and he talked about how recently some burglars tried to take Freud's ashes. It's actually Freud and his wife.
Okay.
Sigmund and his wife. And someone had tried to take the ashes. They had broke into the crematorium. Weird. And they didn't realize that the urn, which is this like ancient Roman or Greek urn, mm-hmm. and they tried to pull it off of the pedestal it was on, but it's like locked down, and they ended up breaking the urn, and the ashes went all over the floor.
No, wait, are you serious?
And the maintenance guy came the next day and found it, and he was the one who like swept all the ashes back into the urn, and then some other guy like rebuilt the urn like piece by piece.
This cannot be real. Like, I don't know if you remember, I made the joke on your Facebook post about, like, you know, don't slip. Don't have a Freudian slip.
You know, I thought you knew about the news story.
No. Because I was thinking how horrible it would be if someone broke that.
Yeah.
They broke it.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Do you realize what happened, though?
What?
First of all, now I guess we're breaking the news here. Freud is alive. Through his insight into human psyche and all these things, apparently he figured out how to transcend death. He was that janitor. And this was his final test. So when you were there waiting patiently, that was part of the psychological test.
Oh.
And then he was unfolding all these little things, and he was asking you questions.
Oh.
That was his final test.
Well, what do I get for passing the test?
Well, you will either live forever or you won't, but you won't know if you passed until you don't die.
Oh. So I'm like a Freud zombie.
Yeah.
Or vampire or something.
Yeah.
But no, it was amazing. I went to Freud's house that he had in London. It's a wonderful museum. And I bought a little cat. Can you see it around the corner? You probably can't see it. But I bought a little black cat, and it's next to my R2-D2 there.
Oh, like a statue of a cat?
Yeah, cat, because Freud had a statue of a cat in his in his office. And I have, as you know, all these little trinkets of cats in my office.
Yes.
Anyway, okay, so why did I talk? Oh, because I was in London, and I also went to see Mother.
But why would we talk about Freud on this podcast? I don't get it.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. By the way, we're going to get to some psychological elements to this movie in a second. But anyway, so Aronofsky, Darren Aronofsky, The Fountain, definitely. So he's basically written and directed just six movies now. Pi, Requiem for a Dream, The Fountain, Black Swan, Noah, and now Mother. But he's also written other movies like Below. He also wrote...
So he didn't write The Wrestler, he directed it or something?
Yeah, he's done a lot of directing. He directed The Wrestler. He produced The Fighter, which is funny.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he produced Zipper, which I haven't seen, and he produced Jackie. Have you seen Jackie?
No, not yet.
I watched that on the plane, actually, on the way back, and it's interesting in some element, but it's actually kind of boring. It's really slow, and there's just a lot of...
Natalie Portman?
Natalie Portman does a great job. She has to carry so much, and I don't know. It was just kind of a little too ponderous.
Is that movie take place post the?
Yeah, it's like the
Kennedy
it's
death?
Just like the week or so after.
Oh, okay.
But it also has flashbacks and stuff, and I kind of wish they did more of the flashbacks. But anyway, he has not won any Oscars. He's been nominated mainly for a lot of movies, mainly Black Swan. But Marissa Tomei won an Oscar for The Wrestler for supporting, which he directed. So I'm wondering if this movie is going to get any Oscar nom. I'm guessing not. But anyway, okay. So I thought the first half was. So let's talk about the first half here.
Yeah.
So you and I have no idea what we're walking into.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking like, oh, this is interesting. It's starting to look like The Fountain. It was like as I was watching, because as she would go up to the wall and she, you know, there's like that heart and then there's that yellow stuff. And I was thinking, oh, it's kind of like Black Swan. It's kind of like The Fountain.
Yeah.
I'm feeling a sort of sense like, because there's no road. You can't see a road. There's no cars.
Right.
There's
and when she sees the forest, it's blurry. They don't show us her view of a clear forest.
Interesting. Yeah. So I was getting the sense of like, is this sort of like a magical, because the fountain has a lot of that in it. There's like these magical parts of it that don't feel stupid, if that makes any sense. Yeah. And I love and it had the wrestler shot where he's right behind her head a lot as she's walking through the house is cool looking and the sound design was awesome in the theater. You know, you get that full 7.1 Dolby sound, you know, and like, you're just like, I'm very much in her shoes. He's very good at putting us in it. And the direction's really great. The writing is really great. And the acting, J-Law was just amazing. I thought she...
Unbelievable. Everyone was great.
Yeah, but particularly... Jennifer Lawrence is a wonderful actress anyway, but the depths of acting that she had to go to in this movie, particularly as you progress through it, I was totally convinced. So the reason why I wouldn't give it more than 7 is because the ending was a little too much.
Amazing.
You liked the ending.
Oh, I loved it.
I thought it was a little drawn out. Like, and I've been giving it some thought in terms of like what I would have preferred it to be otherwise. Uh-huh. And here's my thought. Like if Aronofsky would have stayed within the realm of possible life, you know, up until about 2/3 into the movie, all of this could have happened. Do you know what I mean? I mean, aside from like the sudden wake that happened right after Abel died, right? You know, like it was like just 4 hours after they take that kid to the hospital and he dies, they have this wake. And I was like, why would they have the wake there? Why wouldn't they?
Right.
You know, and I was thinking that's a little unrealistic, but everything up until that point, you're thinking, yeah, that could happen. You know, even the wake, I suppose you could say that's happened. After a certain point, you're like, oh, we've completely gone into surrealism. You know, none of this is possible. I mean, there's tanks chain link fences and Molotov cocktails and, you know.
But so, the threat was there from the very first scene and there was surreality.
The woman crying and there's fire.
And then there was, and by the way, who's not her.
Right, which is great.
And there was surreality immediately that she doesn't react to. Like, whose wall thumps? And you're like, I'm just going to, you know, like, she's clearly experiencing some things that you'd have to think you're going crazy, and she doesn't even mention it, right? So that's surreal.
Yeah, but
right?
Black Swan, you know,
has that plays with that.
All of that you could say is either her hallucinating or the way she felt, if that makes any sense. Sure. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's fine. And now, to me, one of the things that I enjoyed the most was the escalation.
Yeah.
Like, I felt, honestly, like the first time through, because I've seen it twice, the first time through, I felt like on a roller coaster when you keep going up and up and up and you know that it's going to go down. But it's like the Hulk roller coaster in Orlando where the way up is accelerated. That's how it felt. Like, I'm on a roller coaster ride. I know there's going to be a point at which we start going down, but it's actually getting faster as we're going up.
Yeah, no.
And I'm like, what the hell is happening?
I was totally along for the ride, and I was totally into it. There was a woman behind me who was laughing at certain points, like in a way like, oh my God, what is this?
I see.
Because I can totally imagine that. If you're an ignorant dullard, I can imagine laughing at it. You know, don't shug it. If you don't like this kind of thing, you have to go with it. You know what I mean?
Yes,
like if you weren't into it, you'd be like, what am I watching? Like,
the majority of people hated this movie. Hated.
Well, on Rotten Tomatoes, it got 68%.
No, that's the critics.
Right.
The people gave it the overwhelming, it's 1 star, but the average is 2.
Really?
And if you read through the comments, which I did, it is vicious. Like, there are 5-star reviews and there are 1-star reviews.
Yeah.
I only saw a couple of 2 stars.
Yeah.
It's so divisive.
Yeah. So I was with it, but then at a certain point, like when Kristen Wiig starts shooting all those people in the head, I was like, okay, like where, like, okay, get to the next, I get it. Do you know what I mean? The society is falling apart, you know, like, let's get to the next plot point. You know, it just was really long. I was thinking, well, what if the ending escalation was still in the realm of possibility? You know, like maybe there's a fight between different guests because he writes that poem, right? And so people start coming.
Yeah.
And so he's like, yeah, okay, you know, and then let's say people start fighting, and then let's say different cultures are there, you know, from different parts of the world arrive.
Yeah.
And they start having ideological fights, you know, like you have an ISIS guy and you have like a Trump supporter, you know, like then people start having, you know, maybe someone brings a gun and maybe the police are called and maybe it escalates, but it's still within the realm of like what could happen if you were a celebrity who happened to open your doors up to a bunch of random people.
But how could you get her to blow up everything?
Well, so,
and restart the whole cycle.
Well, good. So I thought, and that would take a bit, but imagine like, she's off of her meds, her yellow meds, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she's starting to lose it, which they portrayed really well, you know, yeah. Like, You could just have it be, you know, maybe, and she gives birth, maybe she has her baby at some point, and during all this chaos that God has, let the people, the humans, inflict upon her realm, somehow they accidentally kill her son, her baby, or, you know, something gruesome, and she loses it,
yeah,
and says, I'm done with everyone. I'm gonna kill everyone, or I'm gonna blow up this house, or yeah. something. You know what
well,
I mean?
I would have given your movie a 7, and the reason is because that would have removed from me the element that I loved the most, which was, and I especially experienced this the second time, because the second time I knew what was gonna happen, right? But if you watch it closely, she sort of does too.
Really?
Because from the very beginning, she knows something is wrong. She can feel it, right? She can feel it in the walls. Something is blackening that heart of hers. And there are many moments where she sees the fire creeping in, right? And why would, you know, if it were realistic, right? Why would someone have such an adverse reaction when that first human shows up, right? So like when I'm watching it the second time, I'm like, oh my gosh, I can so much feel like I'm in her shoes more because I know what's coming. So now all this seems all the more horrifying right off the bat. Like, oh no, oh, here comes that horrible woman. Oh, here comes the fight with the kids. Oh no. And like.
Right. So just to pause you, that's the genius of the directing and the acting and the cinematography of this movie is that I felt every emotion that Mother Earth was feeling,
right?
That, you know,
and to wrap up my point about why I felt that the surreal escalation was what the key that did it for me is, it's definitely the first time watching it, but even more so the second time watching it, I'm sitting there going, putting myself in her shoes, and leaving all realms of reasonableness. It's such an extreme because you could have said at first, like, oh, you're not being very hospitable. But then they break his precious thing. You're like, okay, well, they got to go. And then, like, the kids show up and a murder happens. You're like, okay, that's – now we're, like, out of the bounds, right? And then all these fucking people, and then they break that. And you're like, okay, that's ridiculous. But you can still – and then calm returns, and you're like, okay, well, that was stupid. Like, never do that again. But then when the chaos returns, and you're like, wait, there's fucking cops. Now they're killing people. Like, what the – and then there's a war. Like, it's a war zone. And that escalation felt like a train out of control that you have no control of, no input, no say. And that is so beyond your comprehension. And that's what really did it for me. And to the point where like they grab the baby, the baby's killed. And you're like, oh my God, it was so good.
Yeah. So let's talk about
a rush right now.
Let's talk about the symbols here. So it's pretty clear. So some of these symbols are very obvious to me, but some of them are not necessarily true or intended. But it's very intentional that Javier Bardem's character is God, and that J-Law's character is Mother Earth,
or at the very least, a creator. Yeah, and
yeah.
And by the way, I've seen a lot of reviewers that like the movie, but then they'll say, "Oh, But, you know, the symbolism hit me over the head too hard. It was too on the nose.
God, not me.
And I think they missed the point. Because it's not, he wasn't trying to like, well, I'm going to throw in a few little hints and reference. No. It was an allegory from beginning to end.
Right. But I was not, I mean, I didn't, it took me probably until she gave birth or something when I was like, oh, is this a, and then maybe 15 minutes after I walked out of theater, I was like, wait, so there was kind of like a Cain and Abel thing.
Right.
And I was like, does that mean this Adam and Eve?
Yeah, and they got thrown out of paradise because they took the apple, everything.
Yeah, and then everything started because the thing that threw me was the Mother Earth character because you know we don't in Christianity world we think of God and Mother Earth being the same thing essentially. You know, it's like you have the Creator who
there
creates.
Is no feminine.
Right. There's no Mother Earth in the in the Christian Judeo-Christian mythology, so to speak. You know? Although I should say, of course, there are elements within Western culture that incorporates a Mother Earth, a Gaia. You know what I mean? But that's what threw me. You know, because essentially you have two gods. You know, you have or a god and nature.
Yeah.
Which isn't usually sort of broken out like that.
Yeah. And I think that was one of the things that I thought was so artfully done by him, because he didn't actually he wasn't actually retelling the Bible. What he was doing is telling sort of the metaphysical truth upon which a Bible would have been based.
Yeah,
such that, you know,
what truth do you think he was saying?
Well, meaning that what I mean to say is, imagine that there is this truth where there is a creator that must create and has to create and then has some sort of relationship with what we call nature, right? And out of that, every cycle springs out different sets of quote-unquote people or organisms, but it always goes wrong, right? And along the lines, there are always these motifs like brother against brother or the equivalent, right? And there's escalation of hatred or escalation of abuse of the thing we call nature. Every cycle.
Escalation of religion and dogma.
Right. And then you could have imagined that in our real human cycle, very ancient times, people noticed things about reality and wrote them down into what we call the Bible. But that was just like a pale reflection of that bigger truth that he's, and this is a common thing that actually that guy that I don't entirely like, but Jordan Peterson guy, that he talks a lot about these like truer truths upon which things like the Bible are based on. But
do you listen to his podcast?
Who, Jordan Peterson?
Yeah, me too. I started listening to it. Yeah. And I did a whole episode. Did you know I did a whole episode about him and gender pronouns and stuff?
I'd love to get in on that at some point. Yeah.
Do you know his stance on that whole thing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've watched probably, no kidding, 20 hours of him.
Of him talking about gender pronouns?
No. I've seen, I think, all his Bible videos.
Yeah.
And I've seen many lectures he's given and many interviews he's given about the gender pronoun stuff.
I should have talked with you about it. I basically talked off the cuff about it based on the limited information I had and criticized him because, well, let's take a break and when we get back, let's continue with that. What do you say? All right, we're back from the break. Before moving on, I just want to tell everyone that this month's episodes are brought to you by Talkspace. Talkspace is our first and only official sponsor, really.
Woo-hoo!
And it's a wonderful, I think, partnership because we have listeners all over the country, all over the world. I think something like a third of our ongoing listeners don't live in the United States. I think another 15% live in the English speaking major countries, UK, Australia, and wait, what am I leaving out here?
UK, Australia,
Canada. Sorry,
Canada. Of course, forget. Blame Canada.
And then 10% come from other parts of the world.
Do Canadians who use Talkspace have to do like a floppy headed disclaimer?
Yeah, exactly. So the amount of people who contact me and say, I need a therapist, you know, how do you have a recommendation? I'm in Chicago, right, or I'm in Canada, or I'm in blah, blah, blah. And I can't help them. Well, I can now because you can go to Talkspace. The great thing about Talkspace is that they are trying to be, I think, the most legitimate online counseling service. They make sure that all their counselors are fully licensed, meaning that they didn't just graduate. They're fully licensed in their region. And they're also trained. Shannon McFarland. Do you remember Shannon McFarland? She's been on the podcast before.
Yeah.
She was a former supervisee student of mine. She actually works for Talkspace and trains the therapists on how to use the technology and everything like that. So they're trying to be super buttoned up, and they have, you know, therapists all over the place. And the great thing about Talkspace is it's pretty cheap relative to other kinds of counseling.
Yeah,
you can talk with your therapist every day or even multiple times a day.
And you don't have to travel.
And you don't have to travel, or you can travel. You can be wherever you want to be.
Yeah,
And the other nice thing about it, I think, is that I would imagine that if you didn't like your therapist, you could probably switch pretty easily because it's just like a click of a button. You know, it's like, whereas if you're trying to find an in-person therapist, it's a whole process, you know,
it's
much more involved. And so I think because of its low barrier to entry and low barrier to switch, I think if you're out there listening and you're looking for a therapist, you're looking for a counselor, or you just want to, the thing I keep saying whenever I plug this stuff is, you know, a lot of therapy, there's a fair amount of therapy that is what we call supportive therapy, which is not necessarily working on a problem or a psychiatric issue. You want someone to talk to get some support. And this can provide that. You would have someone that you could talk to every day and bounce ideas off of and
that's
kind of
great.
Thing. That's a professional that, you know, will listen well and blah, blah, blah.
And it lets you play the therapist field pretty easily.
Yeah. Yeah. You can, the Tinder of therapy, I suppose. But people out there, you have to use the promo code KIRK, KIRK. I don't choose the promo codes, by the way. It's not my narcissistic, hope that you would use my name. But it's easier than Psych in Seattle or something. Anyway, so it's KIRK. Use promo code KIRK, and that signals to Talkspace that you're one of our listeners and that this sponsorship is worth it.
Nice.
When we get sponsors, it provides us with more funds for this podcast, which means we can spend more time like pontificating about Mother and that kind of thing.
I think I'm going to use the service.
Yeah.
Type in KIRK and then see how long it takes for me to talk the ear off of the online counselor.
You know, Berto, you joke, but if you want to, you actually might want to do it.
Oh, I'm going to do it.
For a couple of weeks and report back.
Oh, all right.
And tell us how it was.
What is it? Challenge accepted.
Yeah. Okay, so Jordan Peterson, the thing that I was saying in general, which was, I actually really like Jordan Peterson. Obviously, you do too.
I have a lot of respect for his education, his approach, and certainly, you know, he's a smart dude.
Yeah. Well, I haven't heard, someone just emailed me, Mr. Zimmerman, I believe, from Toronto today, and saying that Jordan Peterson is this total right-wing, alt-right, you know, like terrible human being.
He has friends in low places because the alt-right embraces him because essentially they can use his angling and his sort of like educational lectures and all these things as proof of like, you see, alpha males, beta males, women suck, gender, all these things are BS.
But does he believe that stuff?
No. So the thing is, it's hard to exactly pin him down on fully what he believes. He comes out hard against fascism and against Nazism and against, you know, misogyny and all these things. However, a lot of what he says happens to be very easily usable by these groups.
Well, he also is very much against this Canadian bill that was designed to discourage trans hate speech, you know, that anyway. The position I was having, because I the little bit that I've probably listened to 10 hours of Jordan Peterson's podcast, and I love it. But occasionally he says things sort of off the cuff, in my opinion, where I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't think you know enough about that topic to go off on, like, he, you know.
And he's a big evolutionary psychologist, by the way.
Interesting. So sometimes he says things and I'm like, you know, but the possibility of anyone totally agreeing with everything that I think is, you know, but the things that he said off the cuff about trans things, I've always just been like, you sound like an old white person who doesn't know what he's talking about. You know what I mean? Yeah. The rest of what he's talking about, I'm like, my God, this guy knows what he's talking about. Yeah. When he's making connections between the Great Flood and Noah and like, right. and psychology and your right. life and child rearing and the meaning of life and society, like, he's making just all these connections, and I'm just like, whoa, like, what's happening?
Yeah. By the way, the problem I have with that is that so on the one hand, when he gained notoriety, it's because he stood up and he said, I'm not going to be compelled to use words that you want me to use. Right or wrong, that's what he stood up and said, and people are like, oh, well, yeah, what a badass.
It's wrong. It's wrong. Right. I mean, the guy is saying, I refuse to acknowledge trans people, is what he's saying. He's saying, I'm not going, just, you know, you were born a certain way, and I refuse to call you anything other than that. That's what he's been saying.
I don't mean to defend him, but I think he would disagree with your categorization. But even
I have quotes from him saying that exact thing.
And I don't, I absolutely believe you do. I still think
and he
would disagree with you.
And he compares it to Nazism of like, he compares it to the not Nazism. He compares it to doublespeak of 1984 like the Big Brother and stuff.
I think what happened though is, because when you put it that way, more people would be against him. What happens is that the way he explained it and the way it came out is like, hey, they want us to use like 72 different pronouns, and they want me to have to use things like G or she or whatever.
But even that is tone deaf, because most trans people will not say, I don't know a single human being who would say, I would like the world to use 72 different pronouns.
Right. But he was saying that they did, and that they were trying to force him to.
Yeah, which is not true.
That's what everyone came out in support of. Not everyone, a lot of people.
Including trans people were supporting
But here's the irony, or the incongruity, that I have a problem with. He mostly stood on a foundation of, you cannot go against biological, quote-unquote, truth, right. which is absolute.
Right.
On the other hand, he has this debate with Sam Harris, and the theme of the first debate is what the word truth and what the concept truth means. And for 2 hours, they're unable to come to eye to eye, because Jordan Peterson continues to say that there is no absolute truth about anything, and you cannot know what was true until the very end of everything and reviewing the entirety of it all. And now I'm absolutely, well, paraphrasing, but saying what he said. And those are so contradictory, right?
Well, I just roll my eyes, because it's so dumb, because the point is there are human beings in our society who, you know, have trans identity, and they're asking this nicely, mostly. And most trans people don't even want to come out of the closet. You know, they don't even want to bother anyone with their trans issues. And the few who actually do come out, because, you know, for whatever reason, the trans people I know are extremely forgiving of when they ask us, can you please refer to me as him or her or they, are extremely forgiving of that whole process. There are exceptions to that rule.
Well, you have way more information and exposure to those communities.
To the fucking reality is the point. That's why the people that support Jordan Peterson's right-wing point of view on this, I just have to say, like, how is your life being impacted exactly?
Well, the problem is that we don't know. Like, because when I first saw his video where he had been confronted by these protesters and things, I was like, oh yeah, he sounds like he's right onto something.
Well, protesters, sure. But, you know, in your real life, like, you know, how many trans people do you know?
Right.
How many of them are actually bothering you?
So ultimately, I'm 100% with you. What I'm trying to say is that at the time when he first, this is 6 months ago, when he first bubbled into my little purview, and I just saw like the little window of what he was saying, what was happening, I was like, oh yeah, he's making a lot of sense. Because what I thought was happening is that he was asking, being asked by law to use 72 different pronouns for 72 different types of people.
Right.
And I was like, well, that seems wrong.
Yeah. And if you actually read the bill in Canada, it's not, that's not what it's saying. Yeah. But the point is, and I'm sure I'll get a billion emails again, because I, you know, we talked about this again. I just want to say for the record, I'm not a Jordan Peterson scholar. And there are people out there who are emailing me and saying, I have read every single bit of Jordan Peterson. I've seen every video. Kirk, you don't understand what you're talking about. Yeah, I don't know. I don't fucking care is the thing. I heard him say a couple things. I actually researched some of his quotes, and I have enough information to go on to say that I think he is tone deaf when it comes to trans issues. Now, I have heard, I enjoy his podcast. I currently have, I think, 20 episodes waiting for me to listen to on my phone right now. You know, but when it comes to trans issues, there are very few people, I think, who are not tone deaf in this society right now. And he just happens to be in the, and there are a lot of people who are scared about trans issues because they don't understand it. They're worried they're going to be called out as a bigot. They're worried that they're going to be prosecuted, I suppose. And if that's the impression that people are getting, then us activists need to like do a better job at communicating to these people, like, relax, or how about we reword this bill so that it doesn't scare you so much? Yeah. Because the bigger point here is no one wants, I hope Jordan Peterson and all his followers don't want trans people to feel terrible about themselves and don't want trans people to be enduring hate speech or hate crimes. I mean, no one wants that, right? The bill, to my knowledge, was designed, at least intentioned, to address that. It wasn't to scare you or to impose some weird ideology on you or to back you into a corner that forces you to commit a crime. Like, no, why would anyone want that, you know? So anyway.
By the way, the reason I brought this this person up was because, see, the movie, which is fiction, right? In my opinion, does a great artful job of what Jordan Peterson lectures about.
Yeah.
The problem I have with the Jordan Peterson approach is he's not saying that here is why the Bible exists how it does because of all these psychological things we have and all these evolutionary things and stuff like that. He's saying that there is this truth out there that the Bible reflects, and that truth is God. He's ultimately religious, and he's trying to couch it as he's backing into it scientifically.
Yeah, he has a question and answer at the end of his podcast. His podcasts are live lectures.
Yeah.
Are they videos too?
He's got lots of videos, yeah.
Well, at the end of his podcasts that are audio only, he does these, and people will ask him point blank, do you believe in God? Or do you believe in Adam and Eve and this kind of stuff? And again, I haven't heard all the things, so if you're one of those Jordan Peterson people, but the things that I've heard, I think pretty artfully dodges the question, or he answers the question in such a way that reflects the enormity of the question. You know, he'll say something like, that question is such a big question, I can't really answer it in this format.
In my opinion, that's BS.
Yeah,
like he's disingenuous about what is being asked.
Well, I think there's two things happening. One is that the way he talks, he brings together both people on the left and on the right.
Yeah.
He brings atheists like yourself together and super religious people together. You know, he brings both people. So I think he knows, if I come out by saying I'm this or that, then half of my, and now he's making millions of dollars right now.
Yeah.
Just being himself talking. Like his Patreon, I just checked because I heard he's making $70,000 a month just on Patreon. That's like beyond his regular job and his speaking engagements and sponsorships and that kind of stuff, if he has any. And so, you know, he knows, he's shrewd enough to know that and that's just guess. I'm just guessing. Anyway, let's get back to the movie.
Let's back to the movie.
So we got God and Mother Earth. We have the house is kind of like Earth, right? And And as she renovates, I kind of had this feeling like maybe life was evolving or something, you know, because it's very plain house at the beginning, right? And she's adding color here, and she's, you know, putting new china and new, you know, everything I thought might be like Mother Earth building complex life forms.
Yeah, evolving.
Yeah. What do you think the heart in the walls exactly was?
So that's her heart, which is not only her heart. It's like that's the continuum of the hearts.
Yeah.
That's why I got that sense, especially the second time. No, only the second time. The first time I didn't really see this. I got that sense that the story had already been told and she somehow knows it but doesn't know it. Hmm. And so that's why that heart remembers. It remembers that everything burns. Mm. And so I got the sense that that's not like the house's heart. Like that is her heart. Because it's the same thing that ultimately he pulls out and yeah. he makes into.
But it's a little weird though because there seems to be a heart in the house.
Yeah.
And there's also a heart in her chest. And there's also a crystal in her chest.
But the crystal is the heart. The
but
heart
there's also
the
a crystal on the mantelpiece.
That's the previous hers.
That's what I'm
heart.
Saying. It kind of loses the... I know it's metaphor and everything, but it felt like there were a lot of hearts, if that makes any sense.
Well, but keep in mind, the previous crystal is broken.
Right.
So it's almost like the previous crystal has to be broken for the new crystal to emerge.
Interesting.
And the god, or the creator, has this... By the way, one of the things I thought was so well done is... At many points in that movie, I was ready to flip on the creator and start hating because I thought, oh, he's about to turn evil or he's about to start beating her or he's about to or he's – and he never quite did.
No.
Even in the worst of moments when he's trying to take her baby, he sits there and waits. And then like that's the closest I came to hating him.
Yeah, he had a hostile edge to him in that moment.
Right.
He's like, okay, I'm going to sit here right. and I know you're going to fall asleep.
Right, and that's the closest I came to hating him.
Yeah.
But then they still do this brilliant job. And Javier Bardem, I mean, oh my gosh, I can't say enough good things because now you see...
You kind of look like him now that I think about it.
I have a little. So he gives up his baby. And I'm like, and that's the first time that a movie I've seen depicting... what a god kind of creature might go through, simultaneously giving up his thing that he values, but because he loves these other things so much.
God, when they,
you know,
when they grab that baby, and I'm just like, oh my god, and like J-Law is freaking out,
yes.
you know, and the baby is, you know, and you're just like,
oh, what's up? And then he's peeing everyone. You're like, oh my god!
And then the next snaps, you hear it.
Crack.
And then she comes through the crowd and they've eaten the baby.
It's just a carcass.
And they're chowing down. Like I was like I think for the people who were like, I don't know if I like this movie, I think a certain sensibility like that scene lost them, I think.
I think a lot of people walked out of the movie and I bet you a lot of them during or right before that.
Or after that.
Yeah.
We got Adam and Eve, which is man and woman in the credits. Adam loses a rib during that right. night when he's all, you know, and Eve shows up. Was in the toilet, was that a rib in the toilet?
No. That one I don't get. Like, because it was a biological thing.
Yeah, it looked like a heart or a tumor.
I thought it was like an abortion from Eve.
Yeah.
You know? Because that was after Eve was around, but before the kids show up.
Oh.
So I thought, and remember there was like bloody tissues on the sink, and she goes to flush them, and then the thing is clogged, and then she goes like that, and then there's this thing, and it's clearly alive, because it expires, it releases blood, and then flushes.
Oh.
So I was like, is that like an abortion? What is that? But I didn't quite get what that one was.
Anyway, then we got Cain and Abel that show up, and Cain kills Abel. Yet another movie that What's-His-Face is in.
Yeah, he's in every movie.
God, what's that kid's name?
It's hard to say, right? Because his name, you think you pronounce it one way, and it's...
God, he's been in so many movies. And he's in more
Black
movies.
Mirror.
Yeah, he's in more movies like this year. The sink breaks from the people sitting on it during
the
party.
Great. She's like, don't sit there. It's not braced.
Yeah.
And like, oh, what? Oh, okay, no,
now,
what's wrong with her?
I read an online review about this, and they're like, who sits on a sink? And I'm like, people sit on fucking sinks. And like, I have been there before. Like, as a homeowner, I have been in a situation where I've been like, why are you sitting on that thing? Right.
But even if they didn't, the whole point is exactly who, after being told, don't sit on the fucking sink.
No, that
continues
part
continues to break the sink.
No, that part, I was totally on board with that. I'm like, that happens to me.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is that's what we are doing.
Yeah.
We are on the sink, bouncing up and down.
Well, so that wasn't us. That's pre-flood. So,
but that's still humans. Yeah. That's still humans. Yeah.
Yeah. So then the great flood happens. And then she gives birth and Jesus. And then we have, I think, John the Baptist, who was that main priest guy.
Yeah, but it isn't, right? Like, I mean, that's what I was trying to say. It's not, he's not actually telling us the Bible.
No, but.
Because if it, for example, if it were.
But there are direct correlates.
Oh, absolutely.
Adam and Eve.
Absolutely. But if it were the human Bible, for example, certainly Jesus doesn't come in our Bible right before the apocalypse. Right, and he
doesn't cosmic
come after
scheme,
modern wars
in the
and
comic,
like that.
In the
right?
comic scheme, in the cosmic, and then we got oil, which is like fossil fuels, or it is fossil fuels, sure. And it's global warming, right? Sure. It's a direct thing.
Yeah,
and then we have the yellow. What was the yellow liquid? Do you think
that she drank.
Yeah,
yeah. What's interesting is there is all the metaphor that we want to apply to it, but remember. He had a job. He was an orthopedic surgeon. They had apparently been together for years, and he's dying from cancer from smoking. None of those things have direct correlates to like Adam and Eve in the garden, right?
Right.
So there are a lot of things which I think are just either methods for him to bring us in with suspense and mystery, or are just, you know, maybe allusions to things like smoking is certainly like abusing your body, but maybe not directly to what there's no story in the Bible of Adam abusing himself.
No, I thought giving this some people are thinking that it's like an anti-hallucination. I read that and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense because she's not hallucinating, you know, to keep her docile, like Xanax or something.
Yeah.
But, and it's also a nod potentially to the Yellow Wallpaper, which is this book or story that was written in 1892. That has very similar themes to this movie, where a woman and a house are combined. But to me, I think it's like you're saying, it's just a device to give us that sense that there's danger and that she needs to take something to calm the beast.
And that once she throws it away and no longer has that, the remainder of the movie is the craziest that she's ever seen.
Right. Okay, so...
And by the way, to your earlier point at the beginning, that is how you could have taken it in a, see, it could all be in her head direction.
Right.
Because that could have been her just going really insane, right? But I don't think it was his full intention to do that.
No. And in fact, if you read interviews with Aronofsky, he's very clear what the story means.
Yeah.
Do you know what his main point is?
Well, I don't know if that's what you read. I read him basically saying the excuse to why he wrote it was that he was going through a dark period and he was very fed up with everything that he had been seeing in the news around the world and he just wanted to let it all out in a burst. That's one interview that I read. But I didn't read an interview about what the meaning is. So you might illuminate.
The main meaning is environmental.
And I certainly got that.
That he's actually a staunch environmentalist. He has been an activist for a number of years. And it's about society and its ills in addition. And one of the main ills is how it is potentially destroying its people are destroying the earth.
And by the way, that is why the escalation and the wackiness was so effective for me because people sitting, and that's also why I found it so ironic that 60 some percent of people absolutely hate the movie because I felt like it's a mirror, you know? And it's a mirror and people see it and they're like, ugh, I don't like that.
Interesting.
Because you're sitting there watching it and you're like, this is ridiculous. What's happening? What are all these crazy people coming in from out of nowhere? But that is literally what our human history looks like.
Yeah.
All these people coming out of nowhere and raping
Yeah.
Just raping.
Yeah. Yeah, I that's interesting. I wonder if that was a factor. I'm apt to just say that stylistically, it's just not, it's too artsy. You know, it's too artsy. I mean, the average person, I mean, Transformers is a huge hit for a reason. It's because it is very palatable, you know?
Well, but Black Swan got much better reviews and did a lot of money compared to this.
Yeah.
And that one was very conceptual.
But had a much, I mean, it had 1% the surrealism, you know? You know, and it was in the midst of ballet and all that kind of stuff. Whereas this is just like, I mean, even for me, there was about 15 minutes where I was like, okay, let's get on with it. It's a little, I get the point, you know, society sucks and war sucks and humans suck and J-Law is being put upon, you know, let's get to the next phase. I remember just going, okay, you know, let's move on.
The part that doesn't ring true, in a more universal way to look at things is in reality, quote unquote, Mother Nature wasn't sitting around being all peaceful like when we arrived, right? The history of the universe is nothing if not, by human standards, brutal.
Yeah.
And empty.
Yeah.
And dark.
But, you know, in the scheme of religion, you could say, or mysticism or myth, you could say that God and Mother Earth came together to say, let's create a perfect Eden, you know,
sure.
for people.
Yeah.
It's which cosmically Earth is the perfect, we're at a perfect place in relation to the sun.
Right.
We have a perfect sun.
With
we have
mass extinctions that have killed billions and trillions of organisms in horrendous instantaneous ways.
But life has survived, which is quite for now, until she hits the button on the oil.
I want to clarify. I'm a huge environmentalist. I do think that we're screwing ourselves over and blah, blah. But in terms of selfishly as humans, we are doing that. Right. In terms of universal, we are right on par with the universe. Like, actually, we're way less destructive than the universe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, supernovae.
Obliterate.
Yeah. Black holes.
Yeah, yeah.
Asteroid collisions. I mean, yeah, there's all sorts of terrible things terrible to us.
To us. To
not terrible to other things.
The universe is just is.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's take a break. When we get back, let's talk about the psychology of the matter. All right, we're back from the break. Just to remind everyone, today's episode is brought to you by Talkspace. Go to Talkspace and use the promo code KIRK, K-I-R-K, to get a discount and also to signal to them that you're one of our listeners, which helps them to stay a sponsor. They've been a sponsor now. This is the third month, which is, you know, a pretty big deal. And if we could get them to be an ongoing sponsor, having a direct sponsor like Talkspace is a big fund flow.
Yeah.
I don't know the accounting terms, but there's a fair amount of ducats.
Influx.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the psychology of the matter. There's not a ton I can say, but there are a few things I can say. One is that it I think metaphorically reflects humans' inability to understand statistics and to understand the big picture. We, in our society right now, are very much concerned with what's in front of our faces, right?
Yeah.
I have to get to work. I have a car. I drive to work. I can't pot, you know, I don't see the pollution in the air.
Right.
I don't feel the earth getting warmer. I don't see the daily species that are going extinct.
Look, the sink is fine. We're bouncing on it and it's fine.
Right. And I'm alive and the people around me are alive and my pets are alive and I see animals on the internet, they're alive. Right. And people are talking about extinctions and global warming. They're talking about, I don't know, 1 Celsius. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I don't, my coastline isn't getting any stronger.
And I've never even seen these animals that they told me were going extinct.
Right. And so it's this cognitive bias, this cognitive problem that we have, which is when we really sit humans down and lay out, particularly people with a open mind to this sort of, you know, idea, they, including you and me, yeah. will agree that we are raping this planet, and we are collectively, including individually, doing terrible, terrible things.
Terrible if we want to survive.
Yeah, if not only
long term.
Well, us, and we've already destroyed several species just because of our use of things that create CO2 in the atmosphere.
Right,
and that is it's a terrible. I mean, imagine if you just walked up to someone and said, "Okay, here's a bomb, and I want you to drop it into that tank, and you're going to kill all of that particular form of coral."
Yeah,
that's the last group of coral of that species left on the planet. Here's a bomb.
Drop it.
And I want you to drop it. They'd be like, no.
That's
I'm not.
Crazy. Who
well,
would do that?
That's what we are doing on a daily basis by using electricity.
We're just painting the walls for you.
Yeah. And so we as humans have this, you know, problem, which makes sense because being on the African savannah 2 million years ago, why would we be selected to understand global warming or the bigger picture when it comes to that kind of stuff, where we evolved and were selected for where's the food in front of my face and how do I have sex and how do I keep safe and how do I keep my family safe and how do I keep warm and what's happening to me right now?
Yeah.
That all goes straight into our limbic system. I'll use that, our primitive brains, so to speak. And that's what guides how we do things. Our frontal lobe is pretty weak compared to the rest of our brain, you know?
Right.
And so I thought that was one psychological thing that I think if you wanted to demonstrate a metaphor of this cognitive problem, this movie is a good example of that.
Yeah. I also felt it was a bit of a feminist message.
Yeah, me too. I thought, in fact, I didn't see much on the internet talking about this at all. What did you think?
Well, clearly, if you had not seen the second half, like let's say you only watched the first half,
right?
I think you probably would have walked out and be like, I think that movie is about sort of an abusive, imbalanced relationship.
Yeah.
Where this woman is trying to make the relationship work, but she is unimportant compared to everyone else.
Right. It had a
man.
Yeah. It had a very familiar gender situation.
Yeah.
You know, he's the worker. She's the homemaker.
Right.
She's very maternal and very caring and very giving. And he is very, he loves her.
Yeah.
You know, he's not abusive. He loves her but she's weak and he's strong. Right.
Now,
he works, he wants to succeed, he's very focused on having accolades and prestige, and he's a little self-centered, but she cares about him.
Right.
I mean, it sort of felt like a 50s relationship.
Yeah. Actually, that's a great way to put it. And it's not that they don't show women who are evil, like, for example, his publicist, right? But then they do show us, like, all the imprisoned women, too.
Yeah.
And
right, there was like a sex trade scene.
And that was a pretty intense moment because she is like now seeing, like in the midst of her trying to like take her baby somewhere safe, she's like, wait, what? Why are all these women now in prison? And this guy comes up to her and essentially evaluates her and is like, no, there's something wrong with her or whatever. And that moment, you know, I also felt was... And lastly, I think there was this association of creation. He's the creator, right? But, and then she's shown as the destroyer. But in reality, well, in the movie's reality, she was trying to create, nurture, make work. And he allowed all the destruction to happen.
Right.
Right. So, you know, I'm not saying it was preachy or anything. It was just, I felt like there was a bit of a feminist theme there.
Totally. I felt even to the end that the, because you could even say that you push women so far beyond the brink and you take and you take and you take and you oppress and you marginalize and eventually she's going to fight back.
Yeah.
And you're going to and you're going to feel like it was justified. I mean, when she destroyed the house, how'd you feel about that?
I felt like she needed to do that half a movie ago.
Right. The way they set it up, it's just like, yeah, good fucking riddance.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, all those people deserved that.
And then I thought there was this brilliant moment where, again, you think, okay, like the God, the creator has lost all credibility. And yet she's like, what are you? And then she's like, why? Right? And he says, like, I'm a creator. If it were enough, because she's like, when is it going to be enough? And she's like, he's like, it can't be enough. If it were enough, I would stop creating. I need the, he doesn't say this, but I need the emptiness to be filled with my creations.
Right.
So it can't be enough. And I just thought that was a brilliant insight into, like the metaphor of existence in a way. It's like, well, if there was nothing, I guess that would solve a problem, but then nothing would be created. Nothing would exist. We wouldn't even be having this conversation. So I can sort of understand how that creator feels. He's like, I know it's sort of a sucky cycle, but like, otherwise, you know, I gotta create.
Right, right. And it's a age old religious debate, so to speak, or philosophical debate around free will and that kind of thing. You know, if you give man free will, then they might choose bad things.
Yeah.
And they might right. destroy things and do unfair things to other humans.
Right.
Where, and if God was good, then God would prevent bad things from happening to people. But what people will say is, well, God gave humans free will and therefore can choose to do wonderful things and can choose to do as evil things as they are capable of. And,
yeah.
and people choose what they're free to choose. Yeah.
The other sense I got was, you were alluding to the Bible. So in the Bible, the text, as if read literally, it really does sound like there's just like this male omnipotence, right? But what this movie is presenting as the metaphor is, well, that thing you call God is actually not just this male figure. It has this feminine part to it.
Yeah.
And him and her are part of this eternal cycle,
right?
Right? And unfortunately, and this is part of that feminist thing, unfortunately, it seems like she's the one that has to keep going through sort of like hell and burning up. But he's going through his own sort of like recurring hell because he loves her and everyone else. And you can, by the way, that's the other thing. You can see that even when they're killing each other and all these things, he still cares so much for these humans, right?
And for her.
And for her.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's always there like, oh, no, listen, I'm here for you.
Yeah. And he keeps saving her. The lighter has a symbol on it that has to do with the harmony between Earth and God.
Interesting. Yeah. I was thinking that it must have a significance.
Yeah. Other morals of the story that we might not have mentioned is God can be perceived. The one thing you can walk away from this movie is, my God, God is a narcissistic dick who really loves humans too much. You know what I mean?
And wants humans to love him.
Another moral story is humans are terrible. You know, I mean, you can't walk away from that movie going like, yay, humans. You know, it's just really God and Mother Earth and to some extent just Mother Earth is the only good human, the only good creatures that exist in this story.
And I get the sense that he keeps trying, hoping that the story will change.
Yeah.
And also, it's hard to tell if he doesn't care that they're destroying everything because he knows that in the end, the story has to carry itself out, or if he doesn't care that they're, or if he cares that they're destroying everything, but he's okay with it. Like, remember that scene where he says, maybe this is when they kill the baby, maybe this could serve a good purpose. Maybe this could change everything. Maybe we need to forgive them. Mm. Right. And so you almost get the sense like that hadn't happened before.
Yeah.
This is the first woman cycle where he has a child.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah. And then he's thinking, maybe if I forgive them, they'll calm down. That doesn't work. Another moral of the story you could pull away is that religious people will use the word of God and distort it to their own selfishness or their own weird sort of societal means.
Yeah.
Because at first people read that poem and they're just like, it changed my life. It's
right.
beautiful. And it seems like this whole very hippie experience, you know, people are coming to the house and everyone's, oh, it's so great. It's all lovey. And everyone's being nice. And then you see essentially society form from that point right. forward.
And then it gets pretty creepy. They're like, boom, zoom, you know, yeah. like chanting and putting ashes on everyone and
right.
eating babies.
yeah. So it Aronofsky, I think he is non-religious, but I think he has a spiritual bent. I think the quote is that he is non-religious, I think, is what he says.
Yeah.
People are saying he's atheist, but I don't think he himself is saying he's... I don't know. But I think he clearly has a religious streak, shall we say.
Right.
Or, I don't know, an appreciation of the Bible, at the yeah. very least.
What was too hard to swallow is that there would be a religion where part of the ritual would involve, like, even metaphorically, consuming and devouring the dead Son of God.
yeah. All right, so let's conclude by going over just some of the other people here. J-Law has been in a bunch of movies, most notably some of these movies. She's been in all the X-Men movies and the Hunger Games movies, of which there's been many, and she's made, I can't even imagine how much money she's made from the Hunger Games movies. But the first movie I saw her in was Winter's Bone. Have you seen that?
No.
It's pretty good. It's kind of slow, but very interesting. Winter's Bone. Yeah, it's the first movie that I remember seeing her in. Basically, it's about these meth addicts in like in rural Kentucky, I think it is.
Oh.
And she is in charge of her two younger siblings, and she's trying to find, I think, her dad. And it's very interesting, and she does great. And imagine seeing this movie, and you're just like, who is this random actress that just is like killing this? She was also in The Beaver, which, have you seen that movie yet?
No.
You got to see it. It's good.
Is this the Fappening?
this is Jodie Foster and...
is this about Leave It to Beaver?
No.
Okay.
It's about... God damn it. Mad Max. What's his name?
Oh, the actor in Mad
yeah,
Max?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
why can't we think of his name? Anyway, he has a mental breakdown, and he finds this beaver.
You mean the new Mad Max?
Yeah. No, the old Mad Max.
Oh, wait. Now you made me forget Mel Gibson's name?
Mel Gibson, yeah.
For crying out loud.
Anyway, it's a good movie. X-Men, Hunger Games, Silver Linings Playbook, which she won an Oscar for, American Hustle, Joy, Passengers, and Mother. Passengers, another movie that was very divisive that you
I liked.
That you and I both liked.
Yeah,
Javier Bardem's from Spain. The first movie I saw him in was Before Night Falls in the year 2000. He was also in Collateral. No Country for Old Men, which he won,
a great job.
Won an Oscar for supporting. Oh, he's in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Have you seen this movie?
I haven't. I know I need to watch it.
Yeah, Woody Allen. It's one of the... It's probably in my top 10 Woody Allen, maybe even top okay. 5 Woody Allen movies. Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and he's great. You know, he's really great in it. Beautiful, Eat, Pray, Love, Skyfall, which I didn't like so much. Pirates.
Well, I liked his role. I didn't like the movie.
Yeah. Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man Tell. I saw the beginning of that movie on the plane.
Oh, and, he's in that?
Yeah, he's the bad guy.
Okay.
and then he's in Mother, and he's been in a whole bunch of other movies.
He just blew me away in this movie.
Yeah, he was amazing. Ed Harris, one of my favorite actors of all time. The first movie I remember seeing him in, 1983, The Right Stuff. He was in The Abyss, which I watched a million times in the 90s. State of Grace, great movie. Glengarry Glen Ross, The Firm.
So good.
Apollo 13, The Rock, Absolute Power,
Everything.
The Truman Show. Pollock, which he also directed.
That was amazing.
Beautiful Mind, Enemy at the Gates, A History of Violence, great movie.
That's the one I still haven't seen that you're always like, you need to watch it.
Man. Appaloosa, he wrote, directed, produces Appaloosa in 2008, which you haven't seen yet.
I know. You got to make me the list of the 10 movies I haven't seen that I must watch immediately.
You got to watch Appaloosa. I recently rewatched this movie. It is so good. I mean, I don't know if you like this sort of thing, but... He directed Pollock and Appaloosa. Those are the only two movies that he directed.
Yeah.
And they're both amazing movies.
Yeah.
He was in Snowpiercer, which everyone loved, and I
did not like that.
Oh, good. You didn't.
And then, that was the, anyways, we could have a whole, that was very overblown. But listen, do you remember at the beginning when he first walks in?
In Snowpiercer?
No. In this movie, in whatever this is called.
Mother.
When he first walks
it's called
in.
Mother!
Mother!
And that sounded like Arrested Development. Mother!
Mother! Javier Bardem and him walk into the house. You know, he lets them in. And do you remember how apprehensive he is at first of coming in?
Yeah.
And then she offers him something to drink, and he almost looks scared.
Yeah.
Why do you think that was?
I don't remember that, but I would suspect that that's a reference to Adam being afraid of God. You know, like Adam and Eve would.
Yes. Okay,
Adam and Eve would talk to God, and they were very. Yeah. They were fearful.
Which, by the way, is why I believe that this isn't meant to be that Javier Bardem is God and she's some other thing. I believe that God, quote unquote, is him plus her.
Yeah.
So that would explain it, because he walks in and he's like, oh, it's almost in awe slash fear.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And he's been in a whole bunch of other things, stage acting, but he was also a voice in Call of Duty Black Ops in 2010.
Oh, by the way, you know what they also did so well at the beginning of the first few scenes? Remember they kept offering her things to drink? Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, yeah, do you want some of this? In my early watching of it, since I didn't know anything, I'm like, oh, don't drink it. Don't drink it. Because I thought she was pregnant at that point. Did you get that sense? Because they kept showing like the heartbeat and they should. So I was like, oh, she must be pregnant.
No, I just thought she's innocent and just doesn't like to drink.
I thought they were going, since I had no idea, I thought they were going like in a devil's baby sort of route. So I was like, whatever's in that, do not drink it. And then later she offers her the lemonade and she drinks the lemonade. And I was like, oh, God.
And she's like, oh,
devil.
Ed Harris has been nominated 3 times, but never won for an Oscar. Michelle Pfeiffer, the first movie I can remember seeing her in, 1982, Grease 2.
She was in Grease 2?
Yeah.
Was she the main gal?
Yeah.
No way.
I believe so.
Yeah. What?
She was in Scarface, which was the first movie everyone remembers her from. Lady Hawk.
Great.
The Witches of Eastwick. She's been in a bunch of stuff, but these are just the movies that I want to highlight. Married to the Mob, Tequila Sunrise, Dangerous. She was, I mean, for youngins out there that listen to this podcast, you do not understand, and maybe you don't understand, the stardom that Michelle Pfeiffer was. She was like, she was perhaps the most famous woman on the planet in the late 80s, early 90s.
I had the biggest crush on her.
Yeah. Dangerously, the Fabulous Baker Boys, which I think takes place in Seattle with Bo and Jeff Bridges.
Oh, really?
Frankie and Johnny, Batman Returns, Wolf, Dangerous Minds. Remember Dangerous Minds?
Yeah. Been spending all our lives living in the something paradise. That was a foreshadowing of this movie.
Ooh. She wasn't in a lot of movies, but then she's in I Am Sam and Stardust. Have you seen Stardust? It's like a sci-fi fantasy movie.
But that's the Neil Gaiman, right?
Is it? I don't know. Okay. But it's great.
Yeah, it's great.
Mother. And then she's on the movie coming out later, Murder on the Orient Express. And she's also in a new Marvel movie, Ant-Man and the Wasp. I can't wait for that to come out.
She was great in this.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen her for a while.
Yeah.
And she was this great mix of like the weathered old gal, but also like there was this sort of sweetness to her, and then that sweetness would turn very sour very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a hard role to pull off. She also has received no Oscar wins, but she's been nominated a few times. All right, what's the final word on Mother, Berto?
Well, so for me, I had one of those experiences that I have very few times in my movie watching, where the whole ride I was enthralled and I came out going like, oh my gosh, this is an instant classic for me. Then I went and saw it for the second time, and I'm cautious because that second time is a true test of a movie you like a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was even more enjoyable. I mean, obviously different because I didn't have the surprises, but I felt like I now could inhabit her a little bit more and be like, this is so horrible. And I feel like I've seen it all before. And
I want to watch
cyclic nature.
Yeah. I want to watch it again too.
So for me, up there, really up there. I'd easily give this one a 9 for me. Maybe even 9.5. And I don't know how it'll age, but right now I'm obsessed with it.
I think this movie will be talked about for a long time in art class and stuff. I think it'll very quickly be forgotten because most people in the general public, you know,
yeah.
maybe not forgotten, but like disregarded or something as like too sensational or too artsy or too difficult to watch or something.
I have a question for you that you might know about. So there were some scenes where I felt the film was a little too grainy looking.
Interesting.
Is that on purpose? Like, do you think that's like, well, that's the style? Or do you think that was lighting or something? Like,
I don't know. Grain usually means that they're cranking the, you know, yeah. I think it's the ISO or something, and meaning that the lighting is too low. And
so I felt like maybe they're doing it on purpose to like sort of signify that this is not quite real. And there were scenes where they would show her and she'd be grainier than Javier.
Well, I think, I mean, speculation. The way they shot the movie, you couldn't have lighting. You had to use yeah. lights that, you know, usually when you shoot a movie, maybe you know this, you have all the lights behind the camera blasting the subject.
Ah, yes, but they had to follow her.
And yeah, they're walking yeah. through this house and you can't have lights. And so you'd have to use lights that are okay to yeah. to be in the set.
That
you
makes
know?
Sense. Yeah.
And so maybe that's why that happened.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, this episode brought to you by Talkspace. Go to Talkspace.com to get your online counseling on and use the promo code Kirk for a discount. I think you get, I don't know, it's a pretty good discount on your first month, I think. I think it makes
I'm going to try it.
So use the promo code Kirk.
I'm going to use the promo Kirk code.
And if you've used it, let us know. Maybe we could use some testimonials, especially if it's good or something. So let me know. Also, let us know what you think about Mother.
All right.
That does it for that episode. Thanks for joining us
Mother!
Out there. Please take care of yourself because...
You deserve it.
Does Mother deserve it?
She did until she blew up the whole enchilada.